This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We mentioned that Saturday Night Live won big at last night's Emmys, including two awards for its portrayals of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton by Alec Baldwin and Kate McKinnon.
They took my microphone to Kenya and they broke it, and now it's broken. And you hear that? It's picking up. Somebody's sniffing here. I think it's her sniffs. She's been sniffing all night. Testing, testing. Gina, Gina. Huge Gina.
Secretary Clinton, what do you think about that?
I think I'm going to be president.
Clearly, millions of Americans love great jokes about politicians. But what about writing great jokes for politicians? A joke is bad enough when it bombs for a comedian. It is nothing compared to an elected official silencing a room with something unfunny or offensive. But a politician with great comedic timing can get a lot of mileage out of a good joke and cement their support with voters, too. Joining us in studio is David Litt, a former speechwriter for President Obama and the author of the book Thanks, Obama. David, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
Also with us is Libby Casey, a video reporter and anchor for The Washington Post. Libby, welcome.
Thanks so much.
And Brad Jenkins is the executive producer and managing editor of Funny or Die DC. Brad, glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you about your background a little bit. Brad, how did you come into comedy writing?
Well, less of comedy writing and more of comedy producing. I grew up in Jersey, in Trenton, New Jersey, and I did nerdy Shakespeare theater, and that was my escape from trying to be an athlete. I was a very bad athlete, but I was a pretty good performer. I worked at the White House for a few years and got to meet pretty much everyone in the comedy world, and I met these Funny or Die guys, and they took me under their wing after a pretty seminal Between Two Ferns moment with President Obama and Zach Galifianakis. So I'm new to the comedy world in a lot of ways. I bring the world of politics and advocacy and progressive activism to the world of comedy in a way that, looking over at my colleague David Litt and I, we feel like should be done a lot more.
And we'll get to Between Two Ferns in a little bit, but for those who don't know, what exactly is Funny or Die, and what are you trying to accomplish here in D.C.?
So Funny or Die is a comedy company. We produce short-form web videos, television shows, comedy, live comedy specials. We produce about 10 television shows right now, long-form television shows. And Washington, D.C., we are bringing the world of comedy to all of the political institutions in town. So everything from nonprofits to foundations to advocacy groups that are trying to reach millions of people. And comedy, David and I have clearly our own perspective here, but we feel like comedy could be a great tool in the toolbox for a lot of these groups. And so we're trying to bring this world of, being able to laugh at yourself, satire, self-awareness, to a world that, for all intents and purposes, has not a lot of humor at all.
Yeah, and David, I do want to ask you more about your background in comedy and how you came into that. But Libby Casey, I see you nodding, I imagine that reflects what you're seeing in terms of how politics and comedy intersect. It seems like more politicians are getting savvy to using comedy as a tool rather than being used by comedy.
Oh, absolutely. And, even veterans of the White House, we just saw Sean Spicer on Jimmy Kimmel's show on September 13th, and it gave Kimmel the biggest ratings he's had in months. People were eager to hear what Sean Spicer was going to say, but part of the appeal was we knew that he would be made fun of a little bit. We knew that Jimmy Kimmel would play some of that classic, spicy from Saturday Night Live, and it happened, and Sean Spicer could laugh at himself, and that's really important. One thing that's new, as we reporters here in D.C., cover this White House, President Trump is not the politician who likes to laugh at himself. He doesn't have that self-deprecating humor that we saw from President Obama, that we saw from President George W. Bush, who, even though they wanted to portray a commander-in-chief mystique, they still could step back and laugh at themselves, and people were really drawn to that. And we're a little mystified about how to quite deal with this White House and the way that President Trump seems to bristle when people do sort of poke the bear.
It's interesting that President Trump really doesn't like to be laughed at, but there is, if you watch one of his rallies, there are a lot of laughs at the rallies, but it's not really laughing with him. It's him laughing at others.
Oh, absolutely. And it seems like you know, an eon ago in politics, but think back to just 1 year ago in the heat of the campaign, the Al Smith dinner in New York, big event, fundraiser for Catholic Charities. And it's a chance for the politicians who are running for president to take a step back and laugh at each other. It's like a roast, but also laugh at themselves. And President Trump, then candidate Trump, was booed. And reporters who were there were tweeting like, I've never seen anything like this, because he poked at Hillary Clinton, but he didn't poke at himself. And we're not used to seeing that because it does tend to win people over if you can laugh at yourself. I mean, I just finished David's book and I feel like I already like know David and like David because he's willing to laugh at himself, right?
Well, let's see if we'll like David too.
Yeah. You can judge for yourself.
Exactly. We'll see after you answer my first question. But yeah, it is a contrast from what we see now from President Trump and what we saw last year and in the 8 years prior with President Obama. How did you come to be writing not only for the president, but writing humor for the president?
So I did stand-up comedy. I grew up in New York City on the Upper West Side, and I used to do amateur stand-up. I was the weirdo 15-year-old at the comedy set. And then when I was in college, I did improv. I interned with The Onion. I thought that's what I was going to do before I saw Obama speak and decided, nope, I'm doing that instead. And all of that is what in D.C. passes for a comedy background. It means I had done some comedy. I had maybe told the joke before.
So wait, how old are you?
I'm 30 now.
Okay.
I was 24 when I started at the White House.
Gotcha.
And when I was there, a speechwriter named John Lovett was sort of the token in-house funny person. And then he left a couple months after I started. And kind of by default, I was the token funny guy. And as Brad was saying, you know, D.C. is not a place where you have to be funny. That's not a part of most job descriptions. So if you can be the funny person in the room, you pretty quickly develop a niche.
Talk about how the White House was dealing with comedy other than you and Mr. Lovett that you saw. Did you see that as the kind of thing people kind of waded into at their own peril? Did people avoid it? Did everybody think, oh, I got a joke for the next speech, and then they all tried it out? Like, how did that work before you got there?
Every so often, you'd have someone try to pitch you a joke for the president, and you'd have to politely say, like, you know, I don't do infrastructure policy. Maybe you shouldn't be sending me this joke. But for the most part, I think people tended to understand, the same as any speech, that the process really matters, and they tended to respect the process. That was one big difference between the Obama White House and the Trump White House, not just with jokes, but with everything, was the outcome is not going to be better than the process that leads to it. And that was true with funny stuff. So we would have maybe 12 joke writers, but that would be former speech writers and a lot of our friends from Hollywood, professional comedians, all pitching jokes. We'd end up with like 600 of these things, and we'd cut that down to 40 before the president even saw them, and maybe 30 in the speech.
We're speaking to David Litt and Brad Jenkins of Funny or Die DC, as well as with Libby Casey, a reporter and anchor for The Washington Post, about comedy in politics. David, you were one of the people behind President Obama's speech at the White House Correspondents Association dinner. This was a speech in which he performed alongside Keegan-Michael Key from the comedy duo Key and Peele and repeated a character that they had used on the show on Comedy Central. Jordan Peele played the president. Keegan-Michael Key played Luther, his anger translator, saying the things that everybody knew that President Obama kind of wanted to say. Here is a clip of President Obama and Keegan-Michael Key performing this bit at the Correspondents' Dinner.
But we do need to stay focused on some big challenges, like climate change.
Hey, listen, y'all, if you haven't noticed, California is bone dry. It looked like a trailer for the new Mad Max movie up in there.
Miami floods on a sunny day, and instead of doing anything about it, we've got elected officials throwing snowballs in the Senate.
Okay, Mr. President. I think I got it, bro.
It is crazy. What about our kids? What kind of stupid, short-sighted, irresponsible bull?
That was Keegan-Michael Key and President Obama at the 2015 White House Correspondents Association dinner. David, how did that bit come about?
Well, President Obama had always been a fan of Key and Peele, and I had basically stalked Keegan-Michael Key at a holiday party at the White House. I had showed up behind him and said, hello, I write jokes for the president. Maybe we can do something together. And he gave me his email, and I didn't think about it. But then 2015, we were coming off this high. Things seemed to be going well. President Obama had, you know, it was at the end of the midterms. He's no longer holding back. And it just seemed like the perfect year to bring Luther the Anger Translator on stage with the president. And what I write about in the book is the hard part for the president was not getting angry that we heard at the end. He told Keegan, he was like, no, I actually do get angry, you know, that's not hard. The hard part for him was just not laughing, because every time Keegan, as Luther, would say something in rehearsal, President Obama would crack up. And right before backstage, he came out and said, you know, this is going to be good. I just can't break. Got to hold it together. And I have to say, I was impressed with him as a performer that he was able to do it, because I could not have done that.
Libby Casey, talk some about President Obama and the way that comedic performances like that affected kind of the politics around D.C. I mean, this wasn't the only time that he pulled off comedy. He slow jammed the news with Jimmy Fallon. He sat in for Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report when they did the show from Washington. What does that mean? We know what it means around the country, just watching it on TV. But here in D.C., as this resume, this audition tape begins to build up for President Obama, what impact does that have?
It humanizes him. I mean, you know, politics aside, it gets a message to a group of people who might not otherwise be able to hear what you're saying, or might not care, might not watch that policy speech in Indianapolis in front of the plant workers, who don't have that interest or tolerance or, frankly, time. And because the media is changing so much and how we get our news is changing so much, you can reach more people with clips that go viral, right? If you are someone who's trying to get a message across and you can go viral online because friends are sharing it and saying, hey, this doesn't just mean something to me, but it's really funny, it's really biting, it really surprised me, you're going to reach more people.
It's got to be infuriating, though, to some folks in D.C. who, as you said, are trying to get a message across.
Just listen to the message.
Exactly. And we're in an era of, like, cat videos and viral comedy video, and President Obama kind of walked that line and made a viral political presence, and I imagine it makes a lot of other politicos kind of ticked that they don't know how to do that.
Well, you know, I think we're trying to figure out at the Washington Post, it's not just politicians, it's also news organizations. How do we strike this balance of getting to you because we're funny and we're sharp and we're smart, but also we're respectful of the news, you know? And so we have this new team at the Post that I'm part of that's trying to figure out how we bring satire in while still being respectful of the brand, right? Not diminishing the hallowed Post Pulitzer Prize winning brand. But I will point out that the Pulitzer Prizes at the Washington Post have also gone to editorial cartooning. And it has been part of our history and heritage since the beginning. And, you know, Herb Block, who's won more than one Pulitzer for his editorial cartooning, coined the phrase McCarthyism. You know, so there is a history of combining funny and satire and also the news. But we're all trying to figure out how to penetrate, because if I can bring you in, if your way in to my newspaper is through a really funny video that's witty and makes you stop and then you stick around to read more, then we feel like we've succeeded.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. I do want to talk more about what the Post is doing with regard to satire, but Brad Jenkins, let me come back to you. If someone in politics, and you mentioned that Funny or Die works with a number of other causes and organizations and so on, kind of helping people, kind of being a comedy whisperer for them. If someone is going to screw up comedy on a political line, where are they most likely to screw it up?
I think it's you have to be funny. And I know that's I know that sounds pretty easy. But, I mean, that's the biggest challenge. I think some of our best comedians always toe that line.
Now, break down funny. I can imagine someone saying, well, I can be funny. Just give me the joke and I'll say it the way you tell me to say it. What's so hard about that?
I think it's just being effective. I think it's being able to walk in the shoes of all people. I think it's being able to be, to David and Libby's point, self-deprecating and self-aware. There is a huge risk. I mean, that's part of the reason why you know, we didn't do many comedy speeches at the White House. There are a lot of issues that, you know, whether it's national security or whether it's issues that are sort of out of the control of from when David writes the word on the piece of paper and when the president says it, that can have huge blowback depending on what's happening and what's unfolding in the world at a moment's notice. So there's a great responsibility when you are the president. There's a great responsibility when you are, you know, just a congressman from the 3rd District of New Jersey. And so I think that there is, of course, reward, you know, in speaking about, you know, being able to have a breakthrough video and be able to reach millions of people and have viral content. But sometimes the risk can outweigh that. And I think that the reason why David's story is so unique is you very rarely find someone at the level that David was writing speeches for the president who also simultaneously was a brilliant joke writer. Those things just don't have, it's like Bo Jackson, you know, you know, Michael Jordan couldn't, you know, play baseball and play basketball very well, right? So I think that's the reason why we were able to have such great success is because you need the best of both worlds. You need a really great writer who knows the policy, who knows the stakes, but also someone who knows the president's voice and can be funny without stepping in it.
But then there also seem to be some politicians who, despite their efforts to be funny or to kind of humanize themselves, as Libby brought up, it seems to always be met with hostility. I mean, a lot of people pick on Texas Senator Ted Cruz, for example, and all of his efforts to try to humanize himself, to try to be more relatable. And it almost seems like the effort itself becomes a deeper level of the joke that is Ted Cruz, and he just can't untie himself from that.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can't just decide that you want to be funny. Like, it just doesn't work that way. It's a craft. It's a craft like anything else. Louis C.K., you know, struggled in comedy stand-up clubs for 20 years before he made his big break. Ted Cruz can't just decide one morning, you know what? I'm going to be funny. And then magically it can happen. I think the reason why the president and David had such success with comedy is because the president is very thoughtful and he's approaching it just like he approaches anything else, right? It's not, oh yeah, let's just throw some jokes around. It's, let's sit down with Keegan-Michael Key, the best in the business. In speaking about viral videos, I mean, their videos literally had like billions of views cumulative. And let's figure out how to make the best piece of content and not just do it for the joke, but do it for a really important issue like climate change.
The other thing that I would say about someone like a Ted Cruz is comedy and political comedy especially is about looking for truth. And it can be about looking for truth about the state of the world. But when you're telling a joke and you're the performer, it's also about finding that truth about yourself. And what makes Ted Cruz so ridiculous, in my biased but accurate opinion, is that he is trying to be funny, he's trying to be relatable, but there's no self-awareness to it. He's not making fun of who he is, he's making fun of who he wishes you think he is.
Let's pause on that for just 1 second. I want to continue on the other side of this break talking about the kinds of comedy waters into which one is able to wade with David Litt, former Obama speechwriter and the author of the book Thanks Obama, Libby Casey, a reporter and anchor for The Washington Post, and Brad Jenkins, executive producer and managing director for Funny or Die DC. I'm interested in knowing whether you think there were certain kinds of jokes that President Obama couldn't tell, or maybe shouldn't tell, because he was the first black president. Stay close. Back now to our conversation about political comedy with Brad Jenkins, the executive producer and managing director of Funny or Die DC, also a former aide in the Obama White House, Libby Casey, a reporter and anchor for The Washington Post, and David Litt, head writer and producer for Funny or Die DC, and a former speechwriter for President Obama. His new book is called Thanks Obama. We were talking before the break about the kinds of comedy that certain politicians can engage in. David, I don't know if you got this sense from being inside the Obama White House, but certainly from outside, as just an everyday citizen, we all perceived a tremendous amount of pressure on Barack Obama because he is the first biracial black president. I imagine that meant there were a lot of jokes that either you wouldn't write or that he wouldn't tell.
Well, we were talking about Luther the Anger Translator before, and that's a perfect example. In the first term, 2012, we had heard, I think it was even from the president, he was like, this is funny, we want to do it. We'd kind of gotten wind he was into it, but we just felt like, do we really want to have a bit that suggests that President Obama is a secret angry black man right before an election? That seemed like a bad idea. So we didn't do it. We held off. We also, I write in the book about how I do not claim to be an expert on race by any means, but I am the world's foremost expert in pitching the following joke. No matter what happens, I think I will go down in history as America's first black president. And A, it's not the best joke, but B, it is something that was so, I think, we took seriously, that we wanted to make sure that the president's legacy on race was not defined merely by his election. And because of that, that joke never made it into a speech. What President Obama did, and that I really admire, he used jokes to lean into that in a way he couldn't in a more serious speech. So in 2013, he said, "Republicans all agree they need to do a better job of reaching out to minorities. Call me self-centered, but I could think of one minority they could start with." And I remember we had a discussion, should we show him the joke written like that? Would he be willing to refer to himself as a minority? And he never, you know, there was no hesitation on his part. He went for it. So often he would go where he would go farther or ask us to be sharper or edgier on all sorts of issues, including race.
What about the president's learning curve? Did he ever bomb?
You know, we were one of the nice things about writing regular policy speeches and then jokes is you learn to be a little risk averse. So if there was a question in our mind, is this joke going to totally fall flat? We would take it out no matter how high the potential reward was. But what I did see was moments in where he would read a joke and either say, you know, that's more of a comedian joke. He wanted to make sure he's playing himself. Or sometimes I write about, we did a taped piece where the first time he read through it, it was okay, but it was a little off. And then the second time, which was about 5 minutes later, it was as if he had been rehearsing for days. And it was crazy. I was like, I was here in the room with you. I know you didn't practice. But it was interesting writing the jokes. You got to see those glimpses into what he brought to the rest of his job as president, because he was able to lock in on, this is the point of a joke, of a policy, whatever, and I'm going to focus in on that faster than anyone else.
The other person I thought in the White House who was really, really funny and also found a comedic voice was Mrs. Obama, the First Lady. What did she think of the jokes you were writing for her husband? She has joked about her husband
right.
being kind of a typical kind of frumpy dad. And when they asked the girls how school was, and he says, well, let me give you my 3-point discussion about the way your school day went.
Right.
How did Mrs. Obama fit into any of this?
Well, every so often you would see that C-SPAN cutaway shot at the correspondence dinner where the First Lady sort of had her head in her hands.
Rolling her
just,
eyes.
Yeah, just yeah. like, oh no. So I think she, you know, I think she took it in stride, but I think there were moments, I think all of us, a significant other sort of looks at you and just says, oh man, you're doing that, huh? Okay.
You kind of need a straight man though. She's
yeah,
a good straight man.
Exactly. And it was, again, that humanizing element that you were talking about, not just that he was out there telling jokes, but that his wife was a little embarrassed for him. I mean, I think many people could relate to that moment.
I kind of thought, Libby, that he was the straight man for her. And yeah. She was like, y'all don't know my husband like I know my husband.
Yeah,
yeah, fair enough.
Yes, him and the dad genes.
But we can all relate to that. We can relate to them as parents, as a couple, the dad genes, you know, absolutely. And politics aside, once again, because I have to look at this from that reporter's eye, that is a connection. That's a connection that you make, and it brings people together. And I mean, God, take it to the news level. Even as we watch these horrible hurricanes and disasters unfold, one of the stories that really resonated was the people coming together. Not stories of humor exactly, but of unity and, hey, you and I look different, we are different, but we can come together in these moments. And, you know, I was talking to Dana Milbank, who's one of our great columnists who writes such funny, biting stuff, skewers the Trump administration, also skewers Democrats, you know, sometimes. He was saying that this is a complicated era to do this job in because it's low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of stuff to make fun of, especially thanks to Twitter and the president using Twitter so much. But it's also really challenging because the stakes are very high. You know, North Korea, we could, you know, have a nuclear war like in 2 hours. And so there's a pressure there of having fun, but also remembering how high the stakes are. But Dana also said that he's having more people come to him now more than ever and say, thanks for writing that column. I just needed to like laugh a minute. I needed to see the humor in this. And I also needed to see the little bit of the dig, you know, I needed to get a little bit of that out. So it's serving an interesting role right now.
It's interesting how, and you were talking about how the Washington Post is navigating satire or trying to kind of to experiment with that. It's interesting how that kind of cathartic expression that you describe with Dana Milbank is also playing out in late night TV. Jimmy Fallon gave an interview to the New York Times a couple months ago where he reflected back on having Donald Trump on the show and kind of playfully tussling his hair, in contrast with what Stephen Colbert settled on after the election night when he admittedly presumed Hillary Clinton was going to win, and he kind of became the presidential critic in chief, and the ratings for the Late Show started beating the Tonight Show for basically the first time in an extraordinarily long time. So it almost seems like comedy is navigating this too.
And Jimmy Fallon had to almost do like an apology comeback tour. I mean, people really skewered him for that, you know, sort of cute moment with this candidate. And he was interviewed by TMZ soon after that happened. And Jimmy Fallon said, you know, have you seen my show? I'm never too hard on anyone. Like, that's not the comedy that Fallon was specialized in and that he's really good at. But that's not what the public's interested in right now. Now, his ratings are still, you know, really good.
They're good.
But that's not what is popping. Those are not the clips people are sending around the next day. It's Stephen Colbert. It's, you know, Seth Meyers finding his voice. It's Jimmy Kimmel talking from the heart about not just his newborn son's open heart surgery, but how he thinks that means people should not be denied health care because they can't afford it. I mean, that is what made that clip, you know, not just about this emotional connection, but this potentially political connection as well.
How is that affecting the way the Washington Post is considering doing satire? Is there something about, and maybe you can just talk about the thought process and what some of the experiments have been, particularly because after the election of Donald Trump, the Washington Post and the New York Times are engaged in this epic newspaper war, which is great for those of us who follow the news. But if you're on the sidelines and trying to figure out how to be funny in the midst of all that really serious reporting, those sound like kind of treacherous waters to dip your toe into.
Definitely. Yeah, a little shark infested. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the key is not to diminish what's happening on the hardcore, you know, really strong reporting that goes on. So don't take away resources from that strong reporting to do the light, funny stuff, right? So keep one lane really vibrant and healthy, even as you figure out ways to tell some funny stories. And like some of my colleagues did this great piece recently where they, for the Apple launch, they turned Siri into Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And, you know, so when you'd ask Siri, you know, my colleague Dave Jorgensen is out for a jog. Siri, you know, where should I go for dinner tonight? And Sarah Huckabee Sanders says, well, I'd have to get back to you on that. You know, so it's taking two cultural things that we're all interested in, the White House press office and the Apple launch, and it's bringing some truth to it. Now, we're not picking sides in any, you know, political battle, but you can still poke some fun at it and say something smart and interesting.
I have heard complaints. We've done shows about political comedy before. I've heard complaints that every time we talk about political comedy, we're actually talking about comedy through a liberal perspective, that it's so hard or just so unlikely that you'll hear conservative comedians get attention in the national press. Now, there are conservative comedians, of course. There have been comedy efforts through conservative outlets. Fox News has tried its hand at comedy before. I wonder what your take is on why it is when we hear 95% of the top political comedy today, it's from the left and not from the right. Why is that?
Well, I think you could turn the question on its head. I mean, when you hear angry talk radio hosts, why are 95% of them on the right rather than the left? And it's a way, I think, that people see the world and communicate. I think there's a stridency that tends, and a certainty that tends to associate itself with conservatism. And there's also a level of doubt and sometimes too much doubt, but probing for the truth, always trying to think through everything. That's a pretty common tendency in a comedy writing room, to the point where it can border on the neurotic, but that's a more left-leaning personality trait. And I think particularly now in a world where the White House, you mentioned, you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she wasn't the one who said it, but she's participating in a White House that talks about alternative facts. And that is now, unfortunately, a value associated with the right, this kind of fungible truth. And on the left, there are still people searching for truth through comedy. And I think often that's why it's funny. I mean, I watched Fox News's half-hour comedy, you know, their daily show. And in addition to the fact that I didn't agree with the political point of view, it was just boring. And I think they didn't quite figure out what the truth was.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Brad Jenkins, what do you think?
I think that there is a history of comedy. I mean, this going back to Shakespeare's days, not to be a nerd here, but the comedian was the truth speaker. The comedian was the one that was really exposing those in power for their misinformation or their lies. And it was really about punching up as opposed to punching down. And I think that you find political comedy really speaks to the heart of people when they are speaking for the voiceless or they're speaking for those that don't have a platform or don't have power. And I think what you're finding now, it really is a glory age of political comedy, in my opinion, right? From Trevor Noah to Sam B to John Oliver, it's not just great comedy. In many ways, it's great journalism because they're pointing out things that I think most, and particularly young people, Funny or Die, I mean, that's our audience, it's young people. They're learning all about the inner workings of gerrymandering and campaign finance reform and all these things that, you know, 3 years ago, Dave and I were at the White House and we were like begging people to pay attention to these issues.
Yeah.
But now, you know, you stop anyone on the street and they're aware and they're fired up. And so a lot of that is about comedy. A lot of that is breaking things down and making it relevant and fun and to Libby's point, shareable, which is a huge new brave new world for comedy.
Let me back up to one of the very shareable videos that President Obama took part in. And Brad, you mentioned this earlier, this 2014 video on Funny or Die that was part of a series called Between Two Ferns, this very kind of low production value, kind of public access TV look-in special that's hosted by comedian Zach Galifianakis. Here is a clip of President Obama going back and forth with Zach Galifianakis on Between Two Ferns.
No, actually, we go to .govs. Have you heard of healthcare.gov?
Here we go. Okay, let's get this out of the way. What did you come here to plug?
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that I wouldn't be with you here today if I didn't have something to plug. Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's the thing that doesn't work. Why would you get the guy that created the Zune to make your website?
Healthcare.gov works great now. And millions of Americans have already gotten health insurance plans. And what we want is for people to know that you can get affordable health care. And most young Americans right now, they're not covered. And the truth is that they can get coverage all for what it costs you to pay your cell phone bill.
Is this what they mean by drones?
That was Zach Galifianakis interviewing President Obama in 2014 on Between Two Ferns, a skit on Funny or Die. Brad Jenkins, I would love to know how this came about, because for me, looking at the skit at the time, I thought, oh, President Obama is going online and getting this comedy interview to kind of take his spanking. This is his way of atoning for the fact that the federal government built a massive website that does not work and that he dropped the ball on his primary campaign promise. This is him standing in the stocks at midday saying, okay, pull out your rotten tomatoes and let's get this over with. Is that the way this, is that what this was?
It, a little bit of that. I mean, to be honest, to be brutally honest, the biggest reason why we did that video was because we were behind in our enrollment numbers in that first year. Because the website, to your point, the launch was a bit of a failure. It didn't work for 2 months. That first year of enrollment was extremely important on the policy side. We needed to hit that CBO estimate. We needed to keep costs down for the consumer. And the only way we can do that is to get a whole bunch of healthy young people to go on a website to sign up for healthcare. And that was not happening. And so what this video did, one, I think you're right. Creatively, this was a way for the president to do some self-aware comedy about how this didn't work. But more importantly, it was a way to say to the millions of young people that watch this cult classic web series that the website works now. And that there are a ton of healthy, uninsured people out there that can get coverage. And so, I mean, it won an Emmy Award, it won a Clio Award, all these incredible things. But the most important thing it did was it drove traffic to healthcare.gov up 40%. So there was this huge spike in enrollments because of this. I mean, it's a hilarious video, but I mean, it's a silly video, to be honest.
We're low on time, and typically at the end of a panel like this, I would ask, you know, who are the political comedians that are on your radar that we should be paying attention to? Since we're talking about politicians doing comedy, who are the funny politicians that are on your radar? Who doesn't get enough credit for being funny just because they're a lawmaker?
I'm going to look at Twitter. I'm going to just throw Chuck Grassley out there, who tweets like the quirkiest stuff sometimes.
Republican senator from Iowa.
Yeah, but that's like the, I mean, part of it is because, you know, he's like this older gentleman, you know, using social media. But
using
the Twitter. So you do see some people popping who you wouldn't expect.
Anybody else?
I'm going to also thinking Twitter, actually, Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut.
Connecticut.
Yeah.
He's been going out there. He's been getting edgy.
Right. And he realizes that these days you want to be risk averse, but you got to take some swings. You got to take a risk.
And Brad, you got any?
I agree. Congressman Ted Lieu
from California.
From California. And the great thing about Ted is he just retweets Trump and it just says, like, WTF. He doesn't really need to do much. Doesn't really need to do much for comedy. It kind of takes care of itself.
That's Brad Jenkins, executive producer and managing director for Funny or Die DC. Brad, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
David Litt, former speechwriter for President Obama and author of the book Thanks, Obama. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
And Libby Casey, an on-air video reporter and anchor for The Washington Post. Libby, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.